The Guardian.
Hello, welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly lockdown episode. I don't know anymore. Barry, nice to see you.
Hello, Max. You're looking lovely, as is your wife's artwork in the background.
Still not yet sold. Maybe we're not delivering it to a big enough audience. There aren't that many people that see me in this particular position, which sounds worse than it's meant to.
Especially in the context of your wife's artwork. A life drawing, you with a bowl of fruit holding your or covering your modesty.
It gets us through the day. How have you been this week, Barry?
Yeah, I'm okay. I've watched a couple of good movies I had recorded and not got around to. The best of them being Dead Man's Shoes by Shane Meadows. Been for a couple of big long walks, and to keep myself amused, I was listening to a kind of rival podcast, The Horn Section, with the comedian Alex Horn and his orchestra. And they had a very special guest on in the shape of you.
They'd clearly run out of funny people. And no, I had a nice time. And I
noticed something, actually. I think you were trying slightly too hard because you're slightly in awe of Alex Horn. Would that be a fair assessment?
I think that's I think you've absolutely nailed it. That's probably fair. How did that come across?
I'm not saying it was bad, but just I was definitely thinking you're trying too hard. And then his orchestra sort of did a backing track for a song you've sung at our live show. Mm. And I was walking around Clapham Common almost in tears laughing, getting some very strange looks from random passers-by who I think thought I was upset about something.
Oh, no, that made my day. Yeah, if you don't listen to that one, I think it's a good podcast for these strange times. Christian has a question for you, Barry. Does Barry actually want the lockdown to end, or does he prefer his quiet life with no commutes and no football?
No, I do want it to end, but mainly because I want to go to the pub. But apart from that, I'm happy enough with it. But yeah, I want to be able to go to the pub. I really, really, really miss the pub.
It's funny because 3 weeks ago you said you didn't really miss the pub.
Yeah, well, now I do.
This is from Frankie88, who says, "My wife has a massive crush on Barry after hearing his voice for the first time the other day. Is he aware he has this effect on lockdown women in their late 30s who haven't seen another man for 4 weeks?"
Well, I'm delighted to hear that. It is, of course, typical of my look that women suddenly start fancying me when there's nothing I can do about it.
David says, "Lockdown has clearly taken its toll on me. I'm listening to Football Weekly solely for Barry's spoken word bit at the end, # no diggity, # La Bamba." We've had some suggestions for this pod, Barry.
Okay.
Will says, "Can Barry give a reading of the lyrics to Ebenezer Good by The Shaman? The public demand it." Nick, "Can Barry read out the lyrics to Informer by Snow, please? # licky boom boom down." And Paul says, "If my first choice of Crazy Frog for Baz is rejected, can I propose Baz Luhrmann Wears Sunscreen or 9 to 5 by Dolly Parton? I hope this becomes a permanent part of the show, as it is epic," he says. I would say loose definition of the word epic, I would suggest.
Well, I have actually heard of every single one of those songs, and I'm happy to do any of them apart from Crazy Frog, which I don't think lends itself to spoken word. Baz Luhrmann's Wear Sunscreen is probably the most appropriate for these traumatic times, but I'm... Yeah, whatever.
I'd like to hear 9 to 5, I think.
But the thing is, no one's doing 9 to 5 at the moment.
Mm, well, maybe we miss it so much, it would be just nice to hear about someone, even... it looked like producer Jonathan... It looked like he shoved a lot of things in his mouth and leant his head back like he was just... This is going to be inappropriate for broadcast. Yes. Anyway, it looked like that even the discussion of you reading out the lyrics to 9 to 5 had taken Jonathan right to the edge. But is still with us, fortunately. So we'll see what happens at the end of the pod. And we should probably crack on because we're doing Jonathan Wilson's This Is Your Life. Of all of This Is Your Lives we've done, I feel like I know this one already. And I feel like it could take a long time, but maybe I'll be surprised.
Correct. Yes, I have a feeling I know most of it already. The Cambodian, or is it Vietnamese monastery? The
clearly don't know it that well.
being attacked by a crow. We'll see. He might surprise us.
Do you want a couple of?
I did very well in his Blizzard quiz the other night. Astonishingly well. I fully expected to get no questions right whatsoever, but I think I came a very respectable 12th out of 120-something teams, and I was on my own.
Well, obviously.
Oh, and sorry, I also left 5 points out there that I should have got, which would have put me up possibly into a top three position.
Coming up next, Jonathan Wilson's This Is Your Life. Welcome to part two, the Guardian Football Weekly Extra. Today's The Life and Times Of is Jonathan Wilson, celebrated author. How are you, Wilson?
I'm very well, thanks. How are you?
Yeah, I'm all right, thanks. All right, let's start at the beginning then, Wilson. What is your first footballing memory?
The first game I went to was in October 1982, Sunderland 1, Southampton 1. And in those days, so I was 6 years old. In those days, when they opened the gates at Roker Park to let people out, you could just wander in for free for the last sort of 20 minutes or so. So my dad being A, really tight, and B, I think kind of quite wisely sort of thinking that a six-year-old kid, probably 90 minutes is a bit too long. We'd go to my gran's for tea. My gran lived about 200 yards off the back of the Roker end. And so we started, you know, going up there, and sort of 20 past four, we'd leave the house and we'd go and... go and walk in and watch the last sort of 20 minutes of games. And that game is also the first game that the Sky Sports presenter Dave Jones went to.
Oh. Did you instantly think, I love this?
I mean, I already love football. So the first game, I mean, we mentioned this with the Italy-Brazil game at the World Cup. The first game I remember watching, and it clearly wasn't the first game I watched, the first game I remember watching was the 1982 FA Cup final. So I was still five then. And then, yeah, I remember watching the replay, and I remember that World Cup being a huge thing. But I mean, my dad had been a season ticket holder, and you know, he'd lived in that, in my grand's house. He'd lived sort of 200 yards from the ground all his life till he got married. And so you know, he'd been a season ticket holder from the end of the war until I was born, and he kind of did the sensible parental thing and stopped going. So he would wherever we were, so, you know, we'd go to Saver Centre to do the shopping, or we'd go to some tedious kind of country house on a Saturday, or we'd go for a walk in Yorkshire or the Lake District or something. But we were always back in the car at 20 to 5 to have the football results. And that was just sort of, that was the trade-off. If we go on a Saturday, we make sure we're finished by 20 to 5. So I remember during that World Cup, we went up to Scotland for like a week in the end of the group stages. And... the late games were too late for me to sit up and watch. So he would go out to the car. Maybe there wasn't even a TV in the guest house where we were staying, but he'd go out to the car to listen to the results. Then he'd write them on a bit of paper and leave them by the side of my bed. So I had them first thing. Football was a huge sort of thing from you know, as soon as I remember.
And do you think your dad was itching for you to be old enough so that he could go back again to Roker Park?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, absolutely. And I remember even sort of if we were out when Football Focus was on, that was like a big deal. We had to be in to watch Football Focus. And I wasn't allowed to sit up for Match of the Day. And I remember my parents were away for some reason. I can't remember why. So this is November 1984, and I stayed at my grand's. And that day, and I remember being in the house at my grand's, and as long as the wind wasn't in the wrong direction, you could hear the ground, so like you knew what the score was because you could hear from the crowd noise what the score was from my inside her living room. So that was a day when, and it's one of the greatest games of football ever played, or one of the greatest halves of football ever played. Sunderland went 2-0 down to Manchester United. Mark Hughes and Dave Hodgson were both sent off for fighting each other, and then Clive Walker scored a hat-trick, including two penalties, all before half-time. And this was on Match of the Day that night. And so, you know, I just lied to my grandson. Like, no, I'm always like sit for Match of the Day. Let me sit and watch this. That was the first Match of the Day I ever watched. And the other game on that day was actually an almost equally incredible game in which Oxford came from 2-0 down to beat Leeds 5-2 and Peter Lorimer was sent off. Although Peter Lorimer was very much the victim when you saw it back.
I'm curious to know, Jonathan, did the six-year-old you at your first game walk in with 20 minutes to go and immediately think that Sunderland needed to switch to a back three and, yeah, move, get extra bodies in midfield?
No. I mean, I walked in and Steve Williams equalised almost immediately with a low side-foot shot into the corner. I subsequently saw that Ali McCoist had got one of his only two goals for Sunderland earlier in the game with what he would call an overhead kick, what I would call a slightly scruffy hook over his shoulder from 6 yards out. I mean, the thing I remember about that was, and yeah, this isn't something kind of particularly unique or new, was just the noise. Just lots of men swearing really loud. And like, yeah, in Roker Park had become this sort of, because I went past it like at least once a week. And I had no real concept of what was inside. You know, I couldn't sort of picture, I'd seen football grounds on telly, but I couldn't picture that football ground. So just seeing what it looked like, I remember being kind of overwhelming. But I mean, you ask about the tactical thing, and I now realise that I must have been a total pain in the ass for my dad to play Sabutio against, because I would spend hours getting the formations right. And that, I think, all stemmed from a Ladybird book, the Ladybird Book of Football, which was recently re-released. And I remember there was, it was just a double page of tactical diagrams, just basic, 4-4-2, 4-3-3, this is what they look like. But there was also a page on the first international, England v Scotland, at the West of Scotland Cricket Ground in Partick in 1872. And the picture that went alongside that, without any reference to it in the text, showed the England lineup being this 1-2-7 formation, but skewed to the left side, four forwards on the left side of the pitch, three on the right. Now, that's not referred to in the text. And when I was writing Inverting the Pyramid, I thought I discovered this formation. I thought I discovered this is what England did by finding a memo written by Charles W. Alcock, who was the secretary of the FA and the man who'd arranged the fixture. He was also from Sunderland, incidentally. And it turns out the Ladybird Book of Football had actually revealed this sort of 30 years earlier.
Who was your first hero?
It would either have been Gary Rowell, who scored hundreds of goals, or Sean Elliott was he was either sort of a ball playing centre back or a tough tackling holding midfielder. He was an England under 21 at national, and he got crocked by Graeme Souness, and had serious knee problems. Never really recovered, but he was suspended for the 85 League Cup final. Which was a huge, huge loss. That's why Barry Venison was the youngest ever captain at Wembley, because he took the armband from him. So Sean Elliott was, you got to go back into the sort of reason why these players were really lauded. So in 76-7, Sunderland finally got promoted with the remnant of the cup final team in 76. But then Bob Stokoe fell ill, and Sunderland had a terrible start of the season. And Stokoe ended up having to resign through ill health, I think the October or the November. And Sunderland were miles adrift at the bottom. And Jimmy Adamson, who'd been the Burnley manager and was famous for bringing through young players, he took over. And he basically said, look, we're going to get relegated. There's nothing we can do. But we've got some promising kids in the youth team. We'll bring them into the first team. So those three players he brought in were Sean Elliott, Gary Rowell, and Kevin Arnott, who was a very technically accomplished midfielder. And Sunderland suddenly started battering teams. So I think it was four home games in a row where we scored five or six. And they got to a position where they should have stayed up. And then on the final day of the season, Sunderland went to Everton. And as long as they didn't lose, they would stay up. If they lost, Coventry were playing Bristol City. And whoever lost that game would go down. But if that was a draw, Sunderland went down. And Coventry delayed kickoff. Jimmy Hill, the Coventry chairman, delayed kickoff. The only game in the history of the 1970s delayed for crowd congestion. So draw whatever conclusions you want from that. And they knew Sunderland had lost, and they played out a 2-2 draw. And the last sort of 15 minutes of that are the players literally sitting on the ground, kicking the ball to each other. So Sunderland were cheated to relegation by Jimmy Hill. And you may remember there was this when Fulham unveiled the statue to Johnny Haynes, this is, I don't know, like 10 years ago, something like that, and they brought out a load of old Fulham legends, Jimmy Hill came out, and Fulham were playing Sunderland, and the reaction from Sunderland fans was so, so loud and so hostile that they had to cancel the ceremony. I was at QPR that day. I was working at QPR, and I got a phone call from somebody going, why do Sunderland fans hate Jimmy Hill? So that, you know, those three players in particular, they were seen as this sort of doomed youth. They were sort of the emblem of this beautiful future that could have been if Jimmy Hill hadn't cheated us.
If we could fast forward a few years, Winston, you went to Oxford. A few questions: A, how did you get in? B, was it a total culture shock for you? And C, how much mockery were you subjected to by your friends for going there?
I'd wanted to take a year out between school and university. I saw other people doing it. It seemed like a laugh. Had a chat to my parents about it. They basically said, look, we can't afford it. Yeah, fair enough. And then I went to the interview, and it went well. There'd been an exam before that as well. And they said, look, there's 10 of you we want to take. There's 8 places, and you're the youngest. Would you mind deferring for a year? So this obviously is like, it's a win-win. I get in, and I get to have my year out. So I went back to my parents and said, look, this is what they've said. Is there any way we can play this? And they said, well, yeah, why don't you go away for 6 months and work for 6 months? And yeah, we can probably kind of cover it if you do that. So I accepted, went off to India and lived in a monastery for 6 months and teaching Tibetan monks. Came back, worked in a pub for 6 months. So, you know, I paid off that debt. And so, you know, the culture shock of, I don't think it'd have been a culture shock anyway, to be honest. Like, I think it's a bit of a myth. I mean, maybe it depends which college you go to, but I've never sort of lived and played football with and worked with and socialized with a more diverse group of people than I did there. The midfield of our football team, there was a Japanese winger. There was he was doing a PhD, and he didn't really mix with us. Not nice enough guy, but he was just very busy. There was a Ghanaian prince. There was me, and there was a lad from a Wirral whose dad was an electrician who'd lost his job because he'd wired up a fridge wrongly, so that the whole front of the door was live.
And I guess if the first time you've really left home is going to a monastery to teach Tibetan monks, then that's your culture shock, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I'm very glad I did that because, well, that whole year was good. You know, the year living in a monastery and then 6 months kind of doing a really difficult crap job in a kitchen was, you know, they were both good things to do.
When did you start thinking, I want to work in football, or I could feasibly make a living working in football?
I stumbled into it. My second year at university, the lad in the year above me who started selling pieces to Match of the Day magazine, and I thought, yeah, that looks like a good way of making a bit of cash on the side. And I'd been working for the Sunderland fanzine since 92, I think. So I'd already, you know, been doing a bit of football writing. Obviously fanzine writing is very different. So I got in touch with Match of the Day magazine, started doing the odd piece for them. And, you know, getting a couple of hundred quid for a piece when you're a student is like, you know, it's a lot of money. And then I did a master's up at Durham and kept on doing just bits and bobs on the side. But I still wasn't really thinking of it as a career. And then I applied to do a PhD and I couldn't get funding for it, thank God. So it was a bit of a loss.
What was the subject?
It would have been constructions of imperial masculinity in the works of Conrad and Kipling, which actually weirdly turned out to be oddly useful when doing the origins of football stuff for Inventing the Pyramid. You know, muscular Christianity and the idea that the sort of thinking wasn't quite to be trusted and it was all about kind of physicality and being tough and doing your duty. And so I worked in factories for a bit. I did a bit of temping, and then some mates were moving down to London, and they had a spare room they were looking to fill, and believing, as all Northerners do, that the streets were paved with gold in London. and more realistically, reasoning that I would have much more fun living in a shared house with my mates than living in my childhood bedroom with my parents. I moved down, did some more temping. And then I did a three-month journalism course starting in January 2000. And then I was very fortunate. I stumbled into a website job that April, pretty much straight away. When I finished the course, I gave myself a fortnight to write off to people to try and find a job in journalism. And I was going to have to go back into temping after that if I didn't. And on the Thursday of the second week in the evening, I went to dinner with some mates from university. One of them brought along her new boyfriend, who was an internet millionaire, which was, you know, in 2000 was sort of a thing you occasionally met. And he said, why don't you apply to these two websites? And so the next day I did. One of them emailed straight back and said, yeah, come in for an interview on Monday. And I started work there on the Tuesday.
And what was that?
That was onefootball.com, which I think still exists in a very different form. But onefootball.com was a very early sort of global football website. It was ahead of its time, really. And the thing that actually screwed us over, we were struggling for a couple of years, but we were pretty close to breaking even. I think we might have got another wave of venture capital. We got taken over by a company which had links to REF, REFF, which was Ray Ranson's company, which loaned money to Leeds and Bradford and others. Basically, when banks wouldn't give you a loan, REF would give you a loan. And when Bradford went bankrupt, the easiest thing for REF to do was to offload the debt onto us, which suddenly saddled us with an enormous, I can't remember the figures, but basically a debt that was a magnitude much, much bigger than our turnover. And so we went under.
Andy writes, have you ever written a book? It's a question from Robert about inverting the pyramid that he says, what is inverting the pyramid? In about 2 minutes or less, I obviously don't want to read it, but I do want to be able to drop it into Shoreditch Football Easter Chat post-lockdown. We joke about Pyramid a lot, but fair to say it is a seminal book about the history of football. How important has that been to your life?
Oh, massively. It's both been the most exciting thing I've ever done and the most lucrative thing I've ever done. So I'd written Behind the Curtain, which is my book on Eastern European football, which did fine. You know, it the sales were okay and it got good reviews. So I was sitting down with my agent, my editor, saying, what should we do next? And I'd just written a big piece on tactics for 442 magazine. And so we were knocking about some ideas and I said, look, I've just done this big piece and I think we could expand that. I think I could go to Ukraine and go to Brazil and go to Argentina and try and talk to these coaches who've had these ideas and talk to players and try and sort of create this global history of tactics and try and trace how one country's influenced another country and how those sort of how the information has passed from one place to the other and how that evolution has developed. And he was already, the editor was already sold on this idea. He'd commissioned a similar book from Peter Ball, who was a journalist who used to work for the Times, but he died before he'd finished it. So the editor was already keen to do this. So I got the commission to do that. And then Sunderland got promoted under Roy Keane. And so I got taken off Pyramid to do a quick book on Sunderland under Roy Keane. Then went back to Pyramid. So Pyramid was the second book I had commissioned, the third book published. There was a real sort of eureka moment when I sort of had this diagram where I was trying to kind of get the whole thing to fit. And it took days and days and days and it wouldn't quite work. And then suddenly it all fell into place. And once it fell into place, it was just this amazing sense of, this is it. This is how the world works. And the thing that proved it was right was I'd found this guy, Doi Kushner, in Brazil, who took over as coach of Flamengo in 1936. And he had tried to introduce WM to Brazil. And Brazil up until the mid-30s had been sort of a very sort of chaotic, haphazard football culture. They'd been significantly worse than Argentina and Uruguay, despite having a much bigger population. And Kushner comes in, he brings these ideas. They're kind of rejected, they're too radical. But he lays the siege, which his assistant Flavio Kushner takes on, and actually takes slightly further than Kushner, and creates a diagonal, which is a halfway step between the WM and the back four. And by the early 50s, Brazil are playing a 4-2-4, which they win the World Cup with in 1958. So Kushner's sort of in Brazil, he was regarded as sort of this alien who'd arrived and given them this great knowledge, but we didn't really know anything about him. And one of the reasons was they misspelled his name. So his name is Kushner, and they were calling him Kushner. They had the R and the U the wrong way around. So when they looked him up, he was never there. And it was a radio journalist called Shondal Ashkel in Budapest. He said, "Are you sure it's Kushner, not Kushner?" Because this guy, Dori Kushner, who played 5 times for Hungary in the 1910s, he worked with Jimmy Hogan at MTK as his assistant in 1918. He was a great centre-half. And I was then able to trace his path. He was very influential in German football. He went to Switzerland. He was sort of, I don't even know what you call him, but he was somebody who, if your club was in trouble, you'd go to him, he'd sort of loans. He sort of kept Swiss football going. He's this great figure. And then suddenly he goes to Brazil. And so I then realized if he existed in Brazil, and I'd made that link of Hungarian football, Jimmy Hogan's ideas going to South America, I realized there had to be an equivalent figure in Argentina. And then I found him, and he was a man who in the first edition of Pyramid I called Emerico Hirschel, which is the Hispanicized version of his name. This Hungarian who takes over Gimnasia La Plata in 1932. And the backstory I found for him was he played with Ferenc Varos when they toured South America in 1929. And so that's what I wrote in the first edition of Pyramid. But the fact that I knew there was a space that somebody had to fit, and I'd found the man to fit it, proved this sort of diagram was right. What I subsequently found was that Imre Hirschel, which is the name he was born with, he's also known as Emmerich and Emerico because, you know, whether you take the German form or the Spanish form of his name, that he'd never played with Ferenc Varos. And this was just a lie that he told to get the job. He'd also claimed to have played for Hakoach, who were this Jewish touring team. Never played for them either. He was a masseur for them. And slowly piecing that together, and the story of Kushner and various other Hungarian emigres, is the story told in The Namesake Long Ago, which is my most recent book.
Here's a question from Derek, which says, has Jonathan ever been involved with coaching backroom staff at any level? As good as a journalist author as he is, does he not feel he could be missing out on his calling?
I think preparing players to play at a high level, I think your knowledge of how the game is played at that level has to be pretty profound. And obviously being a terrible footballer, I don't have that. And I think you see that even when people like Arrigo Sacchi or Jose Mourinho, who don't have much background in football, they find it quite difficult, I think, to be taken seriously initially. Mourinho clearly had the personality. Sacchi got a couple of lucky breaks early on and then had his brief golden period. So I just think that's incredibly hard without that background. The only thing I've been involved in was at university, just with low-level college sides. But that's not really
there
about,
are no tactics in lower level college.
That's football. Not about tactics. That's about getting people to turn up at 2:15 for kickoff. So I just think it's a totally different, it's like the difference between being a film critic and being a director. They're different skills.
I've got some questions from listeners. Will says, how many stadiums has Jonathan watched football in?
Oh, I've got a list. Hang on. Let me have a look. I have been to, if I scroll down at the bottom, I've been to 266 grounds in 50 different countries.
What's your favourite?
Loker Park, obviously. But outside of that, the smaller stadium in Bamako, which had a quarry at one end, was really, really good. But San Siro is amazing. Actually, I hadn't been to San Siro until I went to the Champions League final last season. And that was, last season, 2 seasons ago. 3 seasons ago, whenever it was.
Same.
Three years ago.
It's amazing structure, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's obviously a little bit shabby now and needs doing up. And I know they're going to redevelop it, but it's partly, it's sort of, there's nothing near it. So you walk along that road and you kind of, the sun was sort of setting behind it and you had those, the curved walkways, an incredible sort of sight. And then when you're inside it, the view is great and there's this sort of sense of vastness. And it has, a lot of modern stadiums are a little bit sort of, concrete and plastic, and this obviously is concrete and plastic, but it has this sort of sense of being like a cathedral or something. It's been built on an epic scale,
Peter says, can Wilson please retell the story of the former Sunderland player who declared he couldn't take public transport because, quote, well, you can tell the story.
Yeah. If you look at the piece I wrote on my favourite game, which was Sunderland beating Chelsea 2-1 in the FA Cup quarterfinal replay in 1992, Sunderland's winner comes from, there's a ball from the left towards David Rush, who was this centre-forward, a local centre-forward, like bright blonde hair, who was a bit of an idiot. And he was decent at football, but nowhere near as good as he thought he was. And he had kind of a good month that season. He got a couple of goals against Brighton, played really well. And anyway, he slips, and then Frank Sinclair needlessly concedes a corner because David Rush had scored the winner against West Ham in the previous round. And Frank Sinclair presumably thought, oh God, it's David Rush, I could better be careful. You did not have to be careful of David Rush. And anyway, his career sort of withers, and you know, I think he ended up at Hartlepool.
He played for Cambridge, I remember him.
Right, okay.
Two games for us on loan.
And he was quick, but that was pretty much all he had. And he got done for, I don't know, dangerous driving or drink driving or whatever. And he lost his licence. And then he gets stopped again while he's been banned. And so he goes to court because he's driving without a licence. And his defence, his actual defence in a court of law was, I can't take the bus, I'm a legend.
If I could just follow up, that's vaguely related, Wilson. Why have you never learned how to drive?
Because I'm really malcoordinated and I'd be a danger to myself and others.
Okay.
I mean, I did start to learn to drive, but for various reasons, it was quite a difficult time for my family. And so it wasn't really possible for my parents to help me practice. And so I was just going to lessons and I wasn't really getting any better. And I was sort of thinking, I'm really not. And also, I'm really not very good at stuff I'm not good at. You know, so as soon as I realized, apart from playing football, where I did kind of keep going in the face of irrefutable evidence, I was terrible. but you know, apart from sport, you know, once I've decided I'm not very good at something, I really can't be bothered with it. So I just gave up and I've never really needed it.
Jim says, can Jonathan rate Sam, Leo and Thomas as the heads of forensic teams from Silent Witness out of 10?
I think it was really bad. She's obviously really, really good at her job, but not at management. And so, you know, she was too prickly. And, you know, people who worked under her, they couldn't have been comfortable with that. So I think she's the poorest of them. Obviously, the other two both had, are we allowed to have spoilers for Silent Witness?
Mm, I think so.
They both die heroically. I think I probably preferred Leo, but he just, you know, just 'cause he had a bit more oomph about, a bit more personality. But yeah, Leo, Thomas, Sam would be my order, I think. Thomas's death is more heroic. You know, he knowingly goes into it, whereas Leo just gets sort of caught up in a situation beyond his control.
Peter says, what other British crime procedural drama should I be watching during lockdown? I value your opinion and suspect you'd have made a fairly decent CID detective. Wilson, that is, not Barry.
Well, I love the whole Morse universe, some Morse, Lewis and Endeavour. Vera, I really like, which might be partly conditioned by the fact it's set in the Northeast. Jimmy Hadji, I really liked. It's not really a procedural, but yeah, I thought that was really sort of original and innovative. And I'm watching Babylon Berlin at the minute as well, which is German, and partly that's to help practice my German. And there's some kind of slightly crazy moments in that, but it is good. And it's, you know, it's set in 1929, so you've got the sort of threat of Nazism in the background. Jimmy Hadji, I think, has now gone off iPlayer, but it is available on Netflix.
Peter says, the way Jonathan pronounces the word issue, is the way he pronounces it the correct way? It sounds so regal.
I've got no idea, but I didn't even know there's an issue with it until... Sorry, just done it there. I didn't even know there's a problem with it till somebody pointed it out last year. So I've done it for 43 years. I'm not going to change.
Chris says, didn't Wilson go on Only Connect once, or have I imagined this? Did he say horned viper with one or two syllables on horn?
I wasn't captain, so I didn't have to say it. But we kind of had a perfect Only Connect in that we got well over 20 points both times and lost both times. So we both looked good and never got humiliated by a much better opponent.
And finally, Paul says, does conversing with two buffoons on a podcast ever make Wilson question his life choices?
Well, if it ever happens, I'll let him know.
Thank you, Jonathan.
It's a pleasure.
That'll do for part two. Part three, we'll discuss Newcastle, we'll discuss the Premier League, we'll do the Football League, and Barry reading lyrics. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly Extra. Let's start with Newcastle United then. The takeover hasn't happened yet, but in terms of the reaction to Mike Ashley's potential sale, both beIN Sports and Amnesty have written to the Premier League in the last few days to warn them of the ramifications of sanctioning the sale to the Saudi-backed consortium. beIN Sports accused the Saudi Arabian government of, quote, facilitation of the near three-year theft of the Premier League's commercial rights and in turn your club's commercial revenues through its backing of the huge-scale BeOutQ pirate service. Amnesty International has written to the Premier League to warn that it, quote, risks becoming a patsy of those who want to use the glamour and prestige of Premier League football to cover up actions that are deeply immoral, in breach of international law, and at odds with the values of the Premier League and the global footballing community. Richard Masters, the chief executive of the Premier League, responded to Amnesty saying, "You will appreciate that these matters are often subject to media speculation, but at their heart are due processes required by UK law and by the Premier League's own rules, which cannot be conducted in public and on which we cannot comment. However, I can assure you that these processes go beyond those required by UK company law and that they are applied with equal rigour to every single prospective purchase of a Premier League club." It's interesting, Jonathan, isn't it, that the possibility of a broadcasting rights issue being more likely to scupper this than a human rights issue.
Yeah, and that's unfortunately the position football's got itself into, that the money matters more than humanity, and that's very sad. And you know, I'm really glad this isn't my club in this. I feel really sorry for a lot of Newcastle fans that it's put them in an awful position. I mean, nobody expects them to give up their club, but they must feel a deep sense of sort of unease at this. And you know, it's obviously, this is a much smaller example, but when Paolo Di Canio was Sunderland manager, we had something similar. That his you know, Di Canio's sort of leanings to the right, shall we say, made a lot of people at Sunderland very uncomfortable. And it was very hard to know how you're supposed to respond. You still wanted the team to win. You still wanted them to avoid relegation. But you didn't really want that to be the face of your club. And in the end, we got quite lucky because we avoided relegation and then had a terrible start of the next season. Di Canio got sacked and it was all over very quickly. But this clearly is a very, you know, it's a very different thing, that if hundreds of millions of pounds are pumped into the club, they will start winning more games and they might start challenging for the Premier League. So that sort of broad sort of middle ground of kind of being uncomfortable and not really knowing what to do, I totally understand that. I think what's really sort of distressing is the number of Newcastle fans who immediately, and it's hard to know how many this is. It might just be a vocal minority on social media, but it's not a small minority. You know, it's definitely in the hundreds, who have added Saudi flags to their handles and who suddenly are, you know, attacking journalists for pointing out this doesn't really feel good. And you know, the most astonishing thing is a handful who've started having a go at Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch and pointing out supposed hypocrisy and conspiracy theories involving them. And I guess that's what, you know, part of the point of soft power, isn't it? You kind of, when you get involved with this, you hire your online army to go into battle for you.
I think there's one quite well-known Newcastle fanzine, I think The Mag, who published an article and put it on Twitter. They subsequently took it down in the face of a barrage of hostility from other Newcastle fans, saying that Amnesty International were using Newcastle to get publicity, you know, as if Amnesty International were this little-known organisation. It is quite depressing that the manner in which some, and it is, I suspect, a minority of Newcastle fans have reacted. I would steer them in the direction of a certain number of Manchester City fans who, after their team had clinched the treble last season, I don't think I've ever seen a more unhappy bunch of people. So I suppose it's a slightly be a case of what you wish for, because, you know, you suddenly you go from being a bit of a national laughing stock for your lack of success to clinching the treble and having a fan storm the press box. Your manager loses rag in the post-match press conference and loads of your fans subsequently going berserk on social media because there's a media agenda against them and they're not getting their due. One other thing I'd say is that quite a few Newcastle fans seem to think there is this agenda against their club, whereas I would argue that most people, most neutrals, probably hold Newcastle in quite high regard and quite like them. And that could all end very quickly. They may not care, of course, but that may end very quickly if this thing of fans posting Saudi flags or using MBS as their avatar continues.
So I totally understand why Newcastle fans are desperate to get rid of him. And that's not just because, yeah, he's been a bad owner, that he's hasn't put in the money they think he should put into the club, that he has at times been openly antagonistic to the fan base. It's what he represents. And I think this is where, when you had people like Rio Ferdinand saying, oh, you know, he's got the, you know, he's kept the club in the Premier League and, he, you know, he's kept the finances stable. I think that's where they miss the point. And that's where, and I don't want to pick on Rio Ferdinand particularly, because obviously there are a lot of other people who've said similar things and journalists who've said similar things. It's not just about that. It's where Mike Ashley has made an enormous profit from running his businesses with zero concern for worker rights. Yeah, this is an employer who is described by an MP as running his businesses like a Victorian workhouse. It's an employer who has appeared before government select committees to answer questions about that. Yeah, he operates by 0 hours contracts. He is part of the hollowing out of the post-industrial heartlands of Britain. So there's something going on here that's much bigger than football, and I think that point is often lost. And so I do understand that in terms of practical impact in making your life miserable to Newcastle fans, Mike Ashley has had more immediate impact than the government of Saudi Arabia. I do see that in terms of their locale. I think the other thing to bear in mind, where, you know, from leaving aside the human rights issues that would concern me were I a Newcastle fan about this, is one of the things that's upset them and distressed them about Ashley's reign is the sense that the club's been taken away from them and it's become this marketing tool, this billboard for Sports Direct, of which, you know, obviously the biggest example was the change of name of the stadium, which has since been reversed. Do they think they're going to have more control when the club is run by the Sovereign Wealth Fund of Saudi Arabia? Do they think that when these decisions are being made by people who have to explain their actions to Mohammed bin Salman, their concerns are going to be more taken on board? Of course not. And not only that, but is there any evidence Mohammed bin Salman is actually good at this kind of stuff? Because the two things he's famous for are really misreading the global reaction after the murder of Jamal Khashoggi and launching an oil price war in the middle of a pandemic, which took the price of a barrel of oil into negative territory, neither of which seemed to me to have enhanced the reputation of Saudi Arabia.
The Culture Secretary, Oliver Dowden, spoke at a meeting of the Department of Digital Culture, Media and Sport Committee on Wednesday. He was asked whether he was able or willing to intervene if the Premier League passed Mohammed bin Salman as a fit and proper person, to which he replied, "I think it's a matter for them to carry out. It's a matter for them. I am content that they should carry out that test." The EFL is considering a proposal to extend the summer transfer window until at least the end of January in order for them to raise funds to keep their clubs afloat by selling players. A few clubs in the Football League have made moves to furlough players. Cambridge United have furloughed all of their players. They are going to continue to pay their salaries in full. Fleetwood Town chairman Andy Pillier suggested a way forward for Football League clubs, proposing a salary cap and revamping Leagues 1 and 2, turning them into regional leagues. They've been national divisions since 1958, but Pillian apparently figures that several other clubs think that the savings on travel costs would help fans and clubs weather the storm of the impending recession.
The problem with it is it dilutes the quality significantly. So there's already, I think there's pretty strong evidence of a gulf between the Championship and League 1, and that clearly would be bigger. Because suddenly half the teams in, you know, the, or whatever we call it, the third division north, would actually be fourth division sides. So that's the concern with it. I'm sort of intrigued by this sense that there'd be massive savings. I mean, I'm trying to think where Sunderland's furthest away game would be if you had a northern division. So I guess it would be
Walsall or something.
Peterborough, maybe.
Lancashire. My point is, one of the problems you have is east-west travel in Britain is much harder than north-south travel. So it's to get from the northeast to Manchester takes as long as to get from the northeast to London. Cost-wise, it's not that different. So if they've done the research and they have proved this will save them $100,000 a year or whatever, well, then there is an argument for it. But I'd be very worried about the dilution of quality.
Now, Real FC in the second tier of Welsh football have begun a winding up process. They were founded in 1878. We're heading for a break-even year financially before COVID-19 left them with a £175,000 hole in their finances. Across Europe, the Dutch FA has announced its intention to end the 2019-20 Eredivisie season before another match is played. After the government extended a ban on major events, including matches, until the 1st of September. At the other end of the scale, the Allsvenskan, Sweden's top league, is planning to start its season on the 14th of June with fans in the ground. Sweden are doing things a bit differently to almost everyone else. Schools, restaurants and shops are still open. Susie Rack has been reporting in the paper today that the English FA is set to announce Phil Neville will step down as England's women's manager at the end of his contract next summer. England women will be led into what will now be Euro 2022 by a new manager. Barry, you've talked a lot about Phil Neville and whether he should or shouldn't be there. Does this feel to you like a sort of easy compromise?
Yeah, I don't think he's done a particularly good job. And if they've announced he's going to leave at the end of next season, then it kind of seems, why not just part company now and pay him off and have a fresh start.
Michael O'Neill, another manager who is leaving one of his roles. He's leaving his role as Northern Ireland manager after 8 years in order to solely focus on his position in charge of Stoke. Sung Hoon Min has started his military service in South Korea. He'll apparently be exposed to tear gas, go on long hikes and be trained how to fire a gun.
Well, I was just thinking about this actually, Son, on sort of basic training. He will obviously be the fittest person there by a considerable distance. And if he's handy with a rifle, as he is in front of goal, he'd be pretty good shot too, you'd imagine. So I reckon it'll be an absolute cakewalk for him. I thought he had got himself out of having to do military service by virtue of South Korea winning the Asian Cup, but he still has to do 3 weeks instead of the 18 months he would have had to do otherwise.
Here's a question from Jake. As Detective Wilson, who does Wilson believe is the killer? And is it the same person who set him up? My money's on Jimbo.
Well, I feel I haven't had access to all the available information. What I would say is Detective Wilson is not pursuing this inquiry as I would.
How would you pursue the investigation?
I would sit in a room and look at a laptop and I would draw diagrams on bits of paper stuck to my door while my staff kind of went and did the research. Things would fall into place and I'd realise who the Americo Hirschel figure was.
Well, we'll find out on Chapter 6 what happens. On Monday's pod, the watch-along will be Nicky Bandini and we will watch the final game of Arsenal's title-winning season in 2001-2 at Old Trafford. But that'll do for today. Thank you, Barry Glendenning.
You're welcome, Max Rusher.
Thank you, Jonathan Wilson.
Cheers, thank you very much.
Barry, you're going to read some lyrics?
I can do, yeah. What are they?
Okay, let's do 9 to 5 by Dolly Parton.
Tumble out of bed and I stumble to the kitchen, pour myself a cup of ambition, yawn and stretch and try to come to life. Jump in the shower and the blood starts pumping. Out on the street, the traffic starts jumping, with folks like me on the job from 9 to 5. Working 9 to 5, what a way to make a living. Barely getting by, it's all taken and no giving. They just use your mind and they never give you credit. It's enough to drive you crazy if you let it. 9 to 5 for service and devotion. You would think that I would deserve a fat promotion. Want to move ahead, but the boss won't seem to let me. I swear sometimes that man is out to get me.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.